Hello, this is Wendy Bauer, returning with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated May 2nd, 2016. We continue now with the death notices. Funerals scheduled for today, Monday, May 2nd, 2016. Charles E. Disbrow, 87, of Warrensburg, at 10 a.m. in Warrensburg United Methodist Church. Joan Mary Strutman, 77, of Sepulpa, Oklahoma, formerly of Decatur, at 11 a.m. in St. Bernard Catholic Church, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Funerals pending for Monday, May 2nd, 2016. Rodney Burnett, 69, of Decatur, died Saturday, April 30th, 2016. Arrangements by Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home in Decatur. Chinna Campbell, 50, of Decatur, died Saturday, April 30th, 2016. Walker Funeral Service and Chapel. William Lawyer, 81, of Decatur, died Saturday, April 30th, 2016. Arrangements by Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. Eleanor L. Sullivan, 87, of Decatur, formerly of Assumption, died Sunday, May 1st, 2016. Arrangements by Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. Andrew Washington, 70, of Decatur, died Friday, April 29th, 2016. Arrangements by Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. And now the obituaries from Decatur. William L. Vaughn, Jr., 60, of Decatur, passed away Thursday, April 28th, 2016, in his home. Graveside services to celebrate Bill's life will be at 1 o'clock p.m. Thursday, May 5th, 2016, at Graceland Cemetery. Rex D. Wiley, Decatur. Rex D. Wiley, Sr., 74, of Decatur, passed away Thursday, April 28th, 2016, at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur. Rex was born June 14th, 1941. The family will host a graveside service at 1 p.m. Tuesday, May 3rd, 2016, at Mount Gilead Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the donor's choice. Harold Dean Red Chapman, 74, of Decatur, died at 12:20 a.m. Saturday, April 23, 2016, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Memorial service and burial will be held at a later date. Tanzius Logan Funeral Service and Care is in charge of the arrangements. Joanne Bechtold Chu, Decatur. Joanne Bechtold Chu, 91, of Hot Springs Village, Arkansas, passed away on April 23, 2016, in Lake Hamilton, Arkansas. Memorial service will be at 1 o'clock p.m. Wednesday at Christ of the Hills United Methodist Church with Reverend R. T. Jarrell and Dr. Walter Bubba Smith officiating. Memorial gifts may be made in her name to the Christ of the Hills United Methodist Church, 700 Balearic Road, Hot Springs Village, Arkansas, 71909, or the Arkansas Alzheimer's Association. Bradley Allen Cutler, Shelbyville. Bradley Allen Cutler, 64, of Shelbyville, Illinois, died Tuesday, April 26, 2016, in the University of Chicago Medical Center, Chicago, Illinois. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, May 7, 2016, in Howe and Yaki Funeral Home, Shelbyville, Illinois, with Reverend Greg Breeden officiating. Casual attire is requested. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 o'clock p.m. Friday, May 6, 2016, in the funeral home. Burial will be in Glenwood Cemetery, Shelbyville, Illinois. Family and friends are encouraged to ride their motorcycles or drive their jeeps in the procession to the cemetery. Memorials may be given to Shelbyville Youth Baseball or the University of Chicago Medical Center. Charles E. Disbrow, Warrensburg. Charles E. Disbrow, 87, of Warrensburg, Illinois, passed away on Thursday, April 28, 2016, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Funeral services will be conducted at 10 o'clock a.m. Monday, May 2nd, at the Warrensburg United Methodist Church in Warrensburg, Illinois, with visitation from 4 to 6 p.m. on Sunday, May 1st. Burial will be in the Illini Cemetery in Warrensburg, Illinois. Memorials may be made to the Warrensburg United Methodist Church. Charlotte Marie Frederick Monticello. Charlotte Marie Frederick, 66, of Monticello, passed away at 7:05 a.m., April 27, 2016, at the Kirby Medical Center. A memorial service will be held at 11:30 a.m., Friday, May 6, 2016, at the Christ Lutheran Church, Monticello. A graveside service will follow and be held at 2 o'clock p.m., Friday, May 6, 2016, at the Camp Butler National Cemetery in Springfield. Memorials may be made to the family or Faith in Action of Piatt County. Ada Burris, Decatur. Ada Burris, 60, of Decatur, passed away Saturday, April 23, 2016, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Homegoing services to celebrate Ada's life will be at 1 o'clock p.m. Tuesday, May 3, 2016, at the Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. Visitation will be for 1 hour prior to the services. Margie Merlene Griffin Hurst of Lovington, Illinois. Margie Merlene Griffin Hurst, 69, of Lovington, formerly of Taylorville, passed away on Thursday, April 28, 2016, at 6:20 p.m. at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur. Visitation will be held Tuesday, May 3, 2016, from 10 to 12 noon at Sutton Memorial Home in Taylorville, Illinois. Funeral services will be held on Tuesday, May 3, 2016, at noon at Sutton Memorial Home in Taylorville. Memorials may be made to the American Diabetes Association, 1701 North Beauregard Street, Alexandria, Virginia, 22311. Ann Welch. Ann Welch passed away in Bloomington on April 19th. Celebration of life will be Monday, May 2nd, Trinity Lutheran Church, 801 South Madison, Bloomington, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Funeral to follow on Tuesday, May 3rd, at Wallace Carroll Funeral Home, Herrick, at 3 p.m. Memorials may be made to Trinity Lutheran Church, Bloomington. And now to the local pages from the Crime and Courts section. Rooting Out Drug Traffic, an article brought by Huey Freeman, Herald and Review staff writer. From Decatur. Before executing a search warrant at the home of a known drug dealer, the street crimes detectives took precautions. They worked together with the heavily armed and armored Decatur Police Emergency Response Team for maximum safety for the officers and occupants of the house, located one half block from Eisenhower High School. In a raid on the morning of March 25th, an emergency response officer knocked on the front door. "Decatur police search warrant. Open the door," one officer loudly announced as he stood beside an officer holding a battering ram. After receiving no response, officers broke open the door and entered the dealer's house. At meetings before the raid, there was discussion of the possibility of a young boy being present, but instead, there was only the targeted dealer, who was a 36-year-old male and two adult women. The occupants were handcuffed and questioned. The male admitted he sold marijuana out of his house and said there was about 5 or 6 ounces on the premises. The detectives discovered about 8 ounces with a street value of about $2,300, located under the staircase to the basement. They found about $2,700 in cash in a box beneath an artificial Christmas tree in the basement. The Street Crimes Unit, which includes 13 Decatur police detectives and 3 from the Macon County Sheriff's Office, is a proactive force that primarily conducts narcotics investigations. They closely resemble what was formerly called a vice squad, as they also investigate crimes involving prostitution, illegal gambling, liquor violations, and other non-drug felonies. The detectives and supervisors say it is a close-knit team with high morale. They take pride in taking down drug dealers, partly because so much of the crime in Decatur is closely related to drug use and addiction. A lot of gun violence is connected to illegal use or illegal distribution of drugs, said Dave Daly, who has been with the unit for 16 years. The ultimate goal would be to prevent drugs from arriving in Decatur. By arresting drug dealers, we can prevent a user from obtaining drugs. Daly, an expert on cell phone analysis and historical phone records, said street crimes detectives initiate a majority of their investigations and arrests. We're attacking the drug situation in Decatur several different ways, Daly said. We work on things relevant to our work instead of answering calls for service. A search of a drug dealer's building normally will involve multiple officers, in addition to a canine unit, as dealers employ sophisticated methods to conceal narcotics, firearms, and cash. In the last 16 years, the methods of drug dealers have changed dramatically, Daly said. They are constantly adjusting actions, so we are required to change ours. Sergeant Toby Williams, a supervisor of street crimes for the past 2 years, said the detectives work closely with other Decatur police bureaus as well as local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies. The detectives seize thousands of grams of illegal drugs each year, including cannabis, powder and crack cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, ecstasy, and LSD, Williams said during an interview in his office, which he shares with Sergeant John Platzbecker, a street crimes supervisor since 2009. Through the asset forfeiture process, the unit receives vehicles as well as funding for training and equipment that is used in investigations to combat the illegal drug trade. In 2015, street crimes detectives were responsible for 681 arrests, an average of about 13 each week. The total of cash seized was $454,813.90. Detectives seized or purchased, through confidential sources, about 284 pounds of marijuana, 13 pounds of cocaine, 0.5 pound of heroin, in addition to other illegal substances. 49 firearms were confiscated from suspects last year. Street crimes detectives distinguish themselves by working in several capacities. 4 of the officers, 2 each from the Decatur Police and the Sheriff's Office, work on drug interdiction, intercepting traffickers as they pass through the city or drive on the city streets. One detective is assigned to work with the FBI on its Joint Terrorism Task Force. He takes part in investigations involving recruiting of terrorists and funding of terrorist groups, as well as the planning of terrorist attacks. Another detective works with the FBI to combat gang and drug-related violence with the FBI Safe Streets Task Force. Another street crimes detective serves as a special deputy U.S. Marshal, capturing violent fugitives in Decatur and throughout the Great Lakes region. Williams, who also serves as a sergeant with the emergency response team, said that team is called in to assist with the execution of warrants if it is believed that the suspects are violent offenders. ERT members have more training with SWAT techniques, Williams said. Although the detectives try to gather the best intelligence available, they always try to be prepared for surprises. in some cases, such as the March 25th raid, no firearms were found, despite earlier indications that there was a strong probability of an armed drug dealer. Other houses with no intel of guns, two or three guys are sitting there with guns in their laps, Williams said. In some raids, nothing turns up at all. Our intel might be right yesterday, Williams said. Then they might have moved stuff to somewhere else. We don't like to hit a dry hole, but there are certainties in the work we do. Platzbecker said one of the biggest challenges is to locate narcotics with so many potential hiding places for drug dealers. It can be hidden anywhere, he said. It's their job, their business. Every place contraband can be hidden, we scrutinize as much as possible. If it looks like illegal contraband, we send it to the Illinois State Police Crime Lab for testing. Chad Ramey, the most senior member of the unit, came over to street crimes from patrol in 1999. Here you feel like you're making a big difference, Ramey said. You're locking up someone who's selling drugs. That's one less person who's selling drugs to kids. We have two opinion columns from the opinion page. The first from Jordan Goldberg. A political convention's purpose. What are political conventions for? If you've ever been to one, you might think the purpose is for attendees to schmooze, drink, and drink some more. That holds true for both the delegates and the journalists, who usually outnumber them by at least 3-1. But that's not actually why political conventions exist. They're sort of like volunteer fire departments that almost never get a call. It's not that the firefighters don't want to put out fires, but until they're needed, they're pretty happy to play cards, watch movies, and eat chili. They understand that when the call actually comes, the game ends, the TV goes off, and the boots go on. Originally, conventions were partly a technological solution to a real problem. Phones didn't exist, and mail was too slow to coordinate the desires of the party faithful across a whole nation. Also, a few negotiators want to put all of their bargaining positions in writing. You needed lots of face-to-face meetings. By the 1960s, the telephone started to erode this function of conventions, as my American Enterprise Institute colleague Michael Barron has written. Barron also notes that the media took one of the key jobs away from party bosses, counting delegates. The first media delegate count wasn't until 1968 by CBS News. Not long thereafter, conventions started to resemble infomercials. A political party throws a surprise party for the nominee that isn't a surprise, because the nominee was determined well before the convention. In fact, the nominee is actually the party planner-in-chief, choosing who sings his praises and when. The ending is no more in doubt than the question of whether the Ginsu knife in the TV ad will really be able to cut through the can. But the core purpose of the conventions never disappeared. It just got buried under all the bunting and balloons. Even the communication function of the convention was a means to an end, not the end itself. The real goal was to pick a nominee who could unify the party. That's it. It wasn't to pick a nominee who could win in November. That's a huge consideration, but it was only one very important factor in deliberations over who should get the nomination. Barry Goldwater didn't get the Republican nomination in 1964, nor George McGovern the Democratic nomination in 1972, because they were seen as the best candidates to win a general election. They got the nomination because that is who the delegates, informed by voters, wanted as their standard bearers. Ideally, the candidate who satisfies both criteria, speaks for us, and is most electable, is the nominee, but that doesn't always happen. This is precisely the dilemma the GOP is facing in July. Donald Trump may indeed end up being the nominee, but he's nowhere close to the most electable candidate the GOP could offer, and he's easily the most divisive choice the party could make. Ted Cruz is better on both scores. I would be happy to see him get the nomination. But he also has problems on both fronts. John Kasich has a theory that he is more electable, and he may be right, though I'm unconvinced. But there's very little evidence that many Republicans outside of Ohio want him to be their champion. The current debate about the GOP nominating process, it's rigged, it's undemocratic, is largely hogwash. If it's rigged, it's rigged in favor of the frontrunner, which is why Trump's share of delegates is higher than his share of votes. The nominating system was set up not as some reality show contest to see who can get the most delegates. It was set up to see who can unify the party. The primary system was introduced to give voters the first whack at that task. But they didn't always have the final say. Robert A. Taft got more votes than Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1952, but Ike got the nomination. If Trump fails to get 1,237 delegates, still the most likely outcome, that will mean the voters collectively failed to find a unifier. That failure is the alarm that calls the firefighters, i.e. delegates, to duty. Whether they pick Cruz or Kasich or someone else, it will not be some undemocratic theft. It will be them trying to do their job, unify the party. I wish them luck. And Eugene Robinson writes, Clinton-Warren ticket makes sense. Running mates? It's not even May, and already we're talking running mates? Then let me toss Elizabeth Warren's name into the mix. I'm making several assumptions here in a year when assuming anything is dangerous. First, I believe Ted Cruz's desperate gamble of adding Carly Fiorina to his ticket will fail. He was right to throw some kind of Hail Mary, but I don't see how Fiorina attracts enough new support for Cruz to win the Indiana primary on Tuesday. And if he loses there, he's pretty much toast. Donald Trump's landslide wins this week in the Northeast gave him a bigger haul of convention delegates than even his most optimistic boosters had expected. If momentum still counts for anything in politics, Trump has it. And if he wins Indiana, the polls show him with about a 6-point lead. His path to the Republican nomination looks wide enough to taxi the rest of the way in his Boeing 757. I'm also assuming that Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee. The delegate math is just brutal. There is simply no viable way now for Bernie Sanders to catch up. Sanders appeared to acknowledge reality this week when he announced that his campaign would lay off hundreds of paid staff members. He will use his clout at the convention, he said, to put together the strongest progressive agenda that any political party has ever seen. Which is where Warren comes in. It is absurd to claim that Clinton does not merit the progressive label. She has the scars from decades of attacks by the vast right-wing conspiracy to prove her bona fides. But on most issues, gun control being a glaring exception, Sanders is well to her left. And as his surprising campaign has shown, that's where the energy and excitement in the Democratic Party happen to be this year. If there is a specific issue on which Clinton is weak with the Democratic left, it is not the FBI investigation of her emails. It is her perceived coziness with Wall Street, highlighted by the six-figure speaking fees she was paid by investment bank Goldman Sachs. Sanders' central theme is that the rich and powerful have distorted our political and economic systems to favor their own special interests. He blasts Clinton not only for the Goldman speeches, but also for mining Wall Street for campaign cash. My assumption is that Sanders, should he fall short of the nomination, will give Clinton his full-throated support. But will his most ardent supporters follow? As Clinton's running mate, Warren could erase this potential weakness with the Democratic base. She has spent her Senate career becoming known as the Scourge of Wall Street. No political figure is more closely identified with efforts to curb the excesses of the financial system. Warren would also help address another potential vulnerability. If the general election matchup is Trump versus Clinton, and that seems increasingly likely, it is becoming clear that on the question of U.S. military involvement around the world, Trump will position himself to the left of Clinton. The foreign policy speech that Trump delivered Wednesday was, for the most part, vague and anodyne. His overarching theme is America first, he said. To the extent the phrase means anything, it seems to promise that a President Trump would be extremely reluctant to deploy U.S. combat forces in any sort of world's policeman role. Trump has even questioned the viability of NATO in its present form. Clinton is a foreign policy traditionalist. As Secretary of State, she was more hawkish than President Obama. She pushed for more vigorous intervention in Syria, for example. She has long since apologized for her vote to authorize the Iraq War, but Sanders continues to attack her for it. Trump would surely do the same. Warren wasn't in Congress when the Iraq War began, and national security isn't the issue with which she is identified. But her views fit squarely with those of the party's progressive wing. Warren also has a compelling personal story of having risen from modest beginnings to become a Harvard professor and then a U.S. senator. The fact that she and Clinton would be the first all-female majority party ticket should be irrelevant, but isn't. To many voters, it would be thrilling. I can think of several other potential running mates for Clinton. Funny, but I draw a blank when trying to come up with a suitable partner for Trump. Maybe he'll just go it alone. And from the A3 briefs, from the local pages, from Decatur, attempted arson. Police are investigating an arson attack on a Decatur resident's vehicle while it was parked in her driveway in the 1500 block of North Church Street. Reports indicated the 53-year-old woman discovered Thursday morning that a paper wick had been shoved into the fuel filler neck leading to the gas tank, and an attempt had been made to light it. She told police she had no idea who might be responsible. Also from Decatur, Sun theft suspect. Police reports say a 16-year-old Decatur boy was arrested and charged with theft after he allegedly stole from his mother's purse to pay gambling debts. The suspect was charged with theft over $500, a felony. His 40-year-old mother said the money was taken from the purse in her home on West Olive Street sometime between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. Saturday. Decatur, Republicans' top spot. Republicans will have the first ballot spot on Macon County ballots come November general election. A lottery to determine the order was held Friday in the Macon County Clerk's Office, with Republicans being drawn first. Democratic Party Chairman Jim Underwood and Republican Party Chairman Bruce Pillsbury were present. From Decatur, Health Workshop. Millikan will hold a free health workshop at 6 p.m. Thursday, May 5th, at the Richard Street University Center Fireplace Room. Assessments and presentations will be done by Millikan exercise and science and sports students. Assessments include blood pressure, BMI, life expectancy, waist circumference, and other lifestyle risk screenings. For more information, contact Dr. Tina Cloney at 217-420-6046. And this has been Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review for May 2nd, 2016. I look forward to reading with you again soon. Thank you.